This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. The Republican-controlled New Hampshire House rejects right to work despite the entreaties of Governor Sununu. But the governor finally does get his man, Frank Edelblue, in as education commissioner, and busloads of talk about out-of-state voters and some new numbers out of the Secretary of State's office on out-of-state ID use at New Hampshire polling places. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Thanks for joining us this week. Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union Leader, is here. Casey McDermott, NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Why don't we start with the big news yesterday, the defeat of Right to Work in the New Hampshire House, a defeat made possible by the votes of 32 Republicans who joined Democrats, who all voted against it in the face of efforts by local GOP leaders, the governor, apparently Vice President Pence, to get this bill through. Obviously, Kevin, you've seen your fair share, or perhaps more than your fair share, of Right to Work debates. So what do you make of yesterday's results?
Yeah, I'm always surprised that people are surprised. I mean, this... there's almost three dozen votes in the House since the early 1980s against Right to Work, and there's a reason for that. The political climate just does not exist here. Why? Union membership is at a historic lows in New Hampshire. This is not a pressing issue here. But politically, members of the House intuitively understand one thing, and that is a vote for Right to Work does not get me anything as a Republican legislator. A vote against Right to Work gets me a bunch of people with an axe to grind against me who are going to work to defeat me in an election. That's what was interesting in this week with new Republican state chairwoman Jeanie Forrester, who basically volunteered to set up a fund to help elect Republicans who support Right to Work. She understood politically, like I said, that this has not been a Ken Wynn issue in New Hampshire. And I think going forward, they're going to try to build a constituency for this issue because right now it doesn't exist.
Well, they were trying pretty hard to do that already, and groups like Americans for Prosperity New Hampshire has been on the ground for years working to kind of move the needle on political and public opinion on this. And this year, I think they went as far as to kind of hold, you know, town halls across the state, treat it really like they're running, you know, a political campaign on like this issue alone. So it'll be interesting to see how those efforts, you know, take shape in the next 2 years, given the fact that the issue is effectively off the table for now.
Yeah, this is one of those issues that you see. It's a big issue nationally, Republicans. It's become a litmus test ideologically, regardless of whatever the impact is here in New Hampshire, as Kevin mentioned, not a highly unionized state. Governor Sununu had pushed it as a big part of his agenda for bringing people in, you know, economic development. You know, I think a lot of organizations and states around the country were watching to see what was going to happen here. There are 26 states, mostly in the South and West, that have Right to Work legislation. We would have been the first in New England. So this is just one of those issues that it's a big deal to conservatives, probably more so than the actual impact it would have on the state. So, you know, this is a defeat early on for Governor Sununu. And it'll be interesting to see sort of where it goes from here. It sounds like there may be a move to just sort of postpone it,
I think,
indefinitely.
Well, there's actually, I think, 28 states now, because Missouri and Kentucky this session.
So a little
and
over
I think
half, there was of the, some, half of the states in the country, yeah.
From what I could gather, just looking at kind of the national coverage, there was some optimism that, okay, there's Missouri, there's
gaining
Kentucky
momentum, right,
among proponents that New Hampshire would be next.
Yeah, but not really gaining the kind of traction in the Northeast that it is in these other regions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point. And I get what Governor Chris Sununu was trying to do, set a beachhead for Right to Work. And like you said, Dean, just now, in the entire Northeast, there isn't a state that has Right to Work. So if he were to accomplish this, it would be really significant.
It would have gotten him a lot of attention kind of in the national conservative circles.
Keep in mind now, we're going to talk about Frank Edelblue, who almost beat Chris Sununu in the Republican primary. After that primary, Chris Sununu was broke. His Democratic opponent, Colin Van Ostrom, was flush with money and had Democrats really excited about keeping the corner office. Chris Sununu's only friend at that time
was a governor named Scott Walker, who had just flamed out as a presidential candidate and who went back to being chairman of the Republican Governors Association. As we know, Scott Walker sort of cut his teeth politically on fighting unions and beating back an effort to recall him. Scott Walker and the IGA pumped almost $6 million into Sununu's campaign. He's still badly outspent by Van Ostern, but Chris Sununu doesn't become a governor without that support. And I think Walker lobbied Sununu on this issue. That, again, you can create New Hampshire as this island of free enterprise if you can pass right to work.
I mean, do you think that's why we only heard Governor Chris Sununu give a full-throated endorsement of right to work after the election? One thing was watching the way that he played this was interesting. He didn't talk about it much on the campaign trail. I mean, he said he was running a general election campaign from the start, and this is obviously more of an issue that might get you somewhere in a primary. After the election, he says, this is one of my top priorities. He talked about it in his inaugural address. Obviously, you were at the Republican annual meeting, Kevin, when he invoked it there. He was sort of playing possum a little bit with the press last week. I mean, I asked him, are you working this? And this is what he told me before the vote.
This is a legislative vote. This is a House vote. I respect the boundaries of those lines. If House members want to come in and talk to me about it, I'm happy to talk to them about it. But, you know, we're not out there, banging the walls by any means. We're letting the process take its place.
Well, that was what he said on the eve of the vote. On the morning of the vote, he visited the Republican caucus. My understanding, there was a fair amount of what you could call wall banging, and they're kind of, the us versus them talk that he had at the meeting.
Yes, according to people who were there, he said things like, to Republican members, if you want to vote with the Democrats, you can leave now and do just that. A number of Republicans, I'm told, pro-labor Republicans, got up and left that caucus and weren't happy. I mean, this is not only the first defeat for Chris Sununu as governor, which, by the way, I think he can clearly recover from, and it actually helps him that it's happened early. This created a real fissure in the legislative hierarchy in Concord. Here's former Republican state chairwoman Jennifer Horn after the vote on Facebook. The speaker has failed our party and our state. It's the responsibility of our Republican speaker to do everything possible to advance Governor Sununu's agenda. The speaker knowingly and intentionally appointed a labor committee with a majority of anti-right-to-work representatives. He then handed the gavel to an anti-right-to-work Republican in today's session. Sean Jasper, the Republican speaker of the House.
Well, he has a complicated relationship to right-to-work.
He does.
He voted for it. He attributes his past support for it to a loss on the Hudson Board of Selectmen. He tried to get language explicitly endorsing right to work out of the Republican platform over the summer. That failed. He said he went to Governor Sununu and said, essentially, this is a tough one in the House, and that Governor Sununu basically ignored him, didn't treat him like a partner, and then expected Jasper to deliver on something. And, why don't we listen to what Jasper said after the vote yesterday?
We have to start moving forward. There's got to be some healing. I know there are some people who are very angry with other members of the Republican caucus, and that healing has to take place. So to put it behind us and move forward is what's best for the Republican caucus.
All right. That was Speaker Jasper yesterday after Right to Work was defeated. We touched briefly on the secondary vote to indefinitely postpone this. Does essentially scuttle another right-to-work bill that would have been pending in the House. It bars the legislature from taking up something of a similar subject matter for the remainder of the session. So this is kind of off the table for now. It's obviously going to be back on the table come election season. And, as far as new GOP chair Jeanie Forrester, she says she's going to establish this fund to help support Republicans who support right-to-work. But, is this in some ways, it's a different issue, but in some ways it reminds me of casinos in terms of, it's a vote that somewhat transcends, obviously it has a real ideological component to it, but a lot of the concerns of the individual lawmakers, particularly in the House, can get kind of parochial on this. It was interesting watching the debate yesterday. It was all Republicans, Democrats, wisely sort of stood down on this. One of the Republicans, leading the fight against this, not on the floor, but at the committee level and organizationally, was Fred Doucette, a big Trump backer. I mean, in this moment of populism, you say things stay the same, Kevin. Do you think that this is an issue that may have kind of you know, hit its high water mark and is receding?
Yeah, it's possible. I think Fred Doucette also said, I was one of those rhinos, if you will, Republicans in name only, the Americans for Prosperity, targeted me for defeat, that Casey alluded to beginning at the top of the show. And Americans for Prosperity has identified two people who signed a pledge to oppose right to work. I mean, to support right to work and voted against the bill. They vowed to run against them 2 years from now. So politically, I don't think the issue is going to go away. But as far as its high watermark, this was a pretty aggressive effort to pass right to work. The most aggressive, certainly, we've seen since former House Speaker Bill O'Brien scheduled seven different attempts
when you look at
to
that,
override
when you look at
that, the
veto. That was in a legislature where Republicans had a 3-1 edge, and they passed it, but they couldn't override a veto.
Exactly. And that tells you everything you need to know about right to work here, is that the climate is not opportune here. And I think Chris Sununu, the new governor, did about as well as could be expected to do with an issue such as this and with history such as this.
Well, that's the question. You know, will there be any repercussions for him politically? Sounds like you're saying that he kind of did what he could do. Speaker Jasper, obviously, we just talked about him. Or it may, as we're suggesting, also just kind of be viewed as kind of a function of the quirks in the sort of the composition of the House of Representatives here.
I think he may have overplayed his hand to try and pass this, but since the vote, I think he's pivoted quite well, talking about trying to work with Republicans and Democrats on economic development. I think he'll move to the budget, tax reform, other issues as well that are sort of in his wheelhouse. He has a lot of aggressive initiatives in the budget and a lot of things to move past this fight on.
Well, and like Josh said before, I mean, I followed Chris Sununu throughout his campaign, and I cannot recall offhand a single time when he meaningfully talked up right to work on the campaign trail. It was in his economic plan. It was in his kind of plan. I forget what the name was, but to reboot or revitalize New Hampshire's economy. But that was on paper. It was not part of the stump speech or the conversations that made it into, you know, what helped him to get elected.
All right, join our conversation. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Dean?
Yeah, I was just curious. So, you know, why, if as you're saying, and that's my recollection as well, Casey, you know, why the change at the last minute? Do you feel pressure from, you know, national interest groups? Is there sort of, he got into the office and said, oh, this is something the legislature really wants?
Well, I think if you look at the composition of, you know, he really lucked out in, you know, he's entering government at a time when Republicans have like total control of the state house for the first time in more than a decade. You could see where, you know, there are a lot of people kind of in his ear having conversations about, okay, this is a big priority for us. This might be our one and only chance to pass this in the foreseeable future. So I think from that standpoint, it makes sense why he would maybe shift or emphasize.
And there's the money part of it that
yeah.
Kevin alluded to. Certainly, mm-hmm. if he could do this, this would be a real
set him up
feather
well
in his
for,
cap
right, nationally.
Nationally.
Yeah.
One thing the governor did get this week at last was his man and former rival Frank Edelblue in as education commissioner. No surprise in the 3-2 vote by the council that was party line. You know, this vote followed a letter from the Board of Education to the governor where the board said it, quote, shared public concerns about Frank Edelblue's qualifications. And specifically, it said, we owe the parents the board's full commitment to our statutory responsibility as the board of directors for New Hampshire Public Education. We're prepared for that role and will exercise it with full transparency. You know, sounds like a promise to make sure the public's going to know a great deal about Commissioner Edelblue's dealings, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it certainly does. I think Frank Edelblue got support. Thanks to what Casey just spoke about, this election that put Republicans in charge across the board, including on the Executive Council, 3-2. I mean, the State Board of Education letter from the chairman, Tom Raffio, I won't say it was unprecedented, but it's very unusual for a Board of Education to essentially express these kind of reservations, essentially no confidence in a person they know is going to be their next commissioner, allude to 57 pages of opposition that they had received, hundreds of emails and phone messages and the like that they had received. Even Republicans on the council who voted for Frank Edelblue acknowledged that the majority of contact they had was against Frank Edelblue as education commissioner because he didn't have any experience in public education. I think there's one important thing to remember is Frank Edelblue has the political bug. As people talked about, his website, his campaign for governor, remains active. I think the fears about Edelblue, I don't think they're unwarranted, but I think this is an attempt for him to improve his image politically. This is not Betsy DeVos, meaning an education secretary at the federal level has far more power than an education commissioner at the state level. This person is not a policymaker. I'm not saying this person is figurehead. They're actually an administrator.
Well, why don't that was the point that Governor Sununu and Commissioner Edelblue made after he got his council vote. Why don't we listen to what they told reporters?
We have a great structure here in the state of New Hampshire. We just need to be able to have some leadership to implement on that, and I have no doubt that Frank's going to take the bull by the horns.
And I'm excited to work with the school board, the State Board of Education, because we all have the same goal, which is really making sure that the New Hampshire school system is the best that it can be.
That was Commissioner Frank Edelblue, and prior to that, Governor Chris Sununu, post Edelblue's confirmation vote by the council. And one thing that they talked about when they were talking to us after the meeting was reaching out to Washington, working with the Trump administration to try to create more flexibility for the state. The governor, when he consulted with the Board of Education, invoked block grants, which is something that the Trump administration is envisioning for education. Hard to know exactly what those are going to look like now. But, you know, as you alluded to, Kevin, both on the Board of Education and the council, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny of what Frank Edelblue chooses to do. And one of the things that Councilor Joe Kenney mentioned before he voted for Edelblue that several people cited in the wake of the vote was that no one really knew a lot of these parents who say they were concerned about Frank Edelblue when they were asked, well, do you know anything about the present commissioner or the past commissioner? They didn't even know who they were. That's certainly not a problem that Frank Edelblue is going to be having in the short run. And watching education commissioners can be a slow thing. And so, but when after the vote, you could see, a light in Edelblue's eyes, like he's excited.
Yes.
By this, and he's energetic, and, we don't know exactly what we're going to get, but a lot of people are going to be watching it.
Yeah, I've talked to local officials in major communities who've already been contacted by Commissioner Frank Edelblue. When can I come into the schools in your community? I mean, he's this is somebody, like I said, who's going to be very active, very aggressive, and I think anxious to try and heal the divide if he's able to do that, and be seen as an advocate for all education, not just for homeschool education. He homeschooled all his kids, not just for charter schools or choice education, but for public education as well.
Yeah, I had a chance to interview him during the governor's race, and he was, smart guy, very thoughtful, certainly a politician, very conservative. He said in this context that he was going to be the implementation guy, and, we'll see exactly what that means. We'll see, I think people are, as you mentioned, Josh, people are going to be watching very closely to see what he does. To me, the sort of larger debate over this had sort of a very traditional feel of kind of conservative versus progressive and public education versus, private school and religious schools and parochial schools, et cetera, charter schools. So it kind of fits into that general framework, and, we'll see what he does with it.
Well, and he's going to be working for a governor. I mean, Chris Sununu has been pretty outspoken in terms of his support for education choice. And, in front of the Board of Education, he basically said that, he'd be willing to look at vouchers, which, gets complicated with our Constitution. But, that's a direction that he intends to head. Stick around. More in the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange in just a minute on NHPR.
Bummed that you haven't heard Outside In for a while? Well, podcast subscribers get fresh episodes every other week. Episodes that answer serious questions like, is there more wind than there used to be?
Not to make light of a serious subject, but I also know that you and your husband hate wind chimes.
Oh man, I can't, not in my backyard. I hate wind chimes.
We're going to get mail about this, I hope.
Subscribe to Outside In and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or Google Play.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Joined this week by Casey McDermott, NHPR Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union leader Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. And why don't we go to the phones? Russell's on the line from Dublin. Good day, Russell. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. It's extremely odd to me as a voter that the legislature doesn't seem to know very much about the loss to Manchester of Amersteg Manufacturing in 1931 when the board decided overnight to go to a right-of-work state, Tennessee, and the immediate impact was that 5,000 workers in Manchester lost their jobs and all of the support network for the 750,000 looms that were working on the river in Manchester also lost their jobs. It persuaded Governor Wynant, who was a Republican, to re-enter the race as a Democrat. It persuaded Wynant to follow FDR's lead. And over time, all the rest of New England's governors turned from Republican to Democrat. So we have a long history with right to work, and I'm amazed that nobody's talking about it.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have a long history that stretches back, to that period, but certainly a long history that, like it or not, Russell, looks like it's going to continue. I mean, people are saying this bill will come back. It's been, every session in the last three decades, basically, Kevin.
Yeah, almost three dozen votes. We also have a long history of politics in New Hampshire, of support for law enforcement. And as we saw in this debate, and we've seen over and over and over again, is that public safety unions oppose right to work. And this is important to note, by the way, in some states, including Wisconsin, they have exempted public safety unions from right to work. This bill did not do that. So you had Republicans who are firefighters in the House and Republicans who have family members who were retired public safety workers in the House strongly opposing right to work.
Well, you could see during the floor debate, Majority Leader Dick Hinch invoked that. He said, I come from a family of firefighters. I've seen the good that unions can do for firefighting families, but this is a matter that boils down to freedom of choice and live free or die. And, sometimes the live free or die shout carries the day. Sometimes it doesn't. But why don't we move on from right to work now and move to an issue that Casey is spending a great deal of time on these days, which is our voting laws and new numbers out on state ID use at the polls. This obviously comes in the wake of the latest round of voter fraud claims by President Trump and by Trump advisor Stephen Miller that perhaps Donald Trump would have won New Hampshire, perhaps Kelly Ayotte would have won New Hampshire, but for busloads of people from away coming to vote here, Casey.
Right, and this rumor about so-called buses of voters pouring into New Hampshire in mass numbers is not novel to President Trump or his allies. It's something that, circles all the time after elections. But anyway, so given the kind of, recent revival of this talk, specifically about the idea that because of the nature of New Hampshire's election laws, we have same-day registration, we have a verification system that allows people to use out-of-state IDs along with other documents or an affidavit to register to vote at the polls and cast their ballots, and the follow-up doesn't happen for, months after the fact. There's concerns about, are people pouring into the state over the Massachusetts border or otherwise to vote illegally on election day. So that got me wondering, what can we know about people who are showing up to register to vote for the first time on election day? And the Secretary of State's office actually keeps track of or the town clerks, rather, keep track of when people show up at the polls to register using out-of-state IDs, and then that information gets forwarded to the Secretary of State's office. So I asked the Secretary of State's office for this data. They just gave it to me this week, which was, timely given the kind of discussion around this issue at the national level. And it was interesting to me because it kind of confirmed what you would maybe expect to begin with, is that a lot of the out-of-state IDs that we're seeing on election day are popping up around college campuses. So the top towns and areas for out-of-state ID registrations on election day in November were places like Dover, like Keene, like Hanover, Lebanon, Manchester, where you have St. A's.
Ringe even made it.
Ringe, Franklin Pierce University. We have a map on our website at nhpr.org if you want to dig into this data a little bit more closely. But that really just shows that, you know, if there were buses, we have no proof that there were buses, but if there were, they pretty much, you know, would have headed straight to the college campuses and then kind of spread themselves all across the state in you know, in small numbers otherwise. But there's no proof of this kind of widespread, especially across the Massachusetts border, kind of registration influx on Election Day that is being talked about by some people.
And college students voting in the states in which they go to college rather than their home states, you know, that's been a thorn in the side of Republican politicians for decades. I remember being in college in the early 1980s, and the local Republican congressman in the district that where my school was located constantly complaining about college students being facilitated to the polls, that was unfair. And so, you know, a lot, I think, Casey, you've been covering this extensively. Some of the changes that are being discussed in the state legislature would have the practical effect of, you know, potentially blocking college students from voting in New Hampshire, which, just to remind everybody, the original fraud claim by President Trump was that 3 to 6 people who were in the country illegally, not people who just simply voted illegally, but people who were here in the country illegally voted in the last election. And we've sort of, the whole debate has kind of morphed into all sorts of other issues about duplicative registrations and dead people still being on the rolls. But the original claim was that people who were here, undocumented people who were here, were voting in the election, that they in some way were able to kind of do this in large numbers. And there's just zero evidence of that. But well, it is, as you mentioned, it's sort of a, it's been kind of a electoral mythology that's been around for decades.
Well, and it's, you know, it's worth reiterating that under current law in New Hampshire, it's perfectly legal for college students, out-of-state college students, to vote here using proper documentation or otherwise following all of the applicable laws at the polls. Now, with the stipulation, again, that that's under current law. Like you said, there are a number of bills before the legislature this year that would, you know, tighten up, I think is the kind of favored terminology, the state's voting rules so that, you know, for example, our definition of domicile or residency would no longer include the phrase for the indefinite future, which, you know, some people worry could, if not, you know, explicitly disenfranchise people, could create confusion among people who otherwise would register to vote, and that would discourage them from registering to vote. There are other efforts to, you know, change the requirements for what kind of college IDs students are allowed to use at the polls, change the type of IDs that anyone is allowed to use at the polls, to create new rules for when someone would lose their domicile for voting purposes. So, for example, if they claim a homestead exemption in another state or pay taxes in another state or do other things that would, you know, signal that they, you know, have kind of ties to other states that would make that, you know, more of their domicile than New Hampshire.
Yeah, it would also mean explicitly say this domicile change, which, by the way, has the support of Secretary of State Bill Gardner.
Right.
And also the co-sponsorship of 12 of the 14 Republicans in the state Senate. This would say people who came to New Hampshire to work on campaigns would not be eligible to be voters. Referring to tax breaks, this would have disqualified Walt Havenstein, right, the Republican nominee from governor, from being the Republican nominee for governor when we broke the story that he had qualified for 2 resident tax breaks while living in Maryland.
And actually something that's come up in the hearings on this, which I find kind of interesting, is that often when you think about these changes relative to domicile or the amount of time that someone lives in the state, it's often talked about in terms of its impact on college students who are here, you know, 9 months out of the year. But it's worth noting, too, that New Hampshire in particular has a sizable population of people who have second or third homes here, who might live here for part of the year but live, you know, in Florida or other parts of the country. So there's also a question of what that means for those people as well. But that doesn't often come up explicitly in terms of the consequences of some of these bills.
You know, I follow these legislative battles very closely, but I always have in the back of my mind that these kinds of legislative initiatives are always ripe for legal challenges. They voting rights challenges, civil rights challenges. So, you know, this stuff is going to end up in court at some point, regardless of what the legislature decides to adopt and the governor decides to sign.
Well, the emails are piling up on this. We have an email from Peg who writes, "It's very unfortunate we have such extravagant stories being perpetrated by Washington, and when reported, we're told that the news media is making them up. Tragic for our democracy," says Peg in Concord. Deb writes, "While I've not observed voter fraud, I know of many specific instances that I would consider voting irregularities that violate the spirit of the law. Young campaign workers live with local families working for their candidates in the primary, voted in New Hampshire using their host family's addresses." You know, there we have it, both sides. And, you know, the backdrop of all this is a question of enforcement of current law. And that's the second half of this. We have our laws and then we have the enforcement. And, you know, people who believe that there's a lot of voter fraud going on have a valid concern in that there has not been much enforcement of these laws. There has been some, but the Attorney General's office says it doesn't have the resources.
I mean, they've been open about the fact that they just have not enforced or followed up on the investigations that have been sent their way. Basically, I guess just what happens is that, you know, after the election, if someone signs an affidavit or doesn't provide all of the documentation but still casts a ballot, what happens is the Secretary of State's office sends them letters to the address that they provide on those forms. If those letters come back undeliverable or if they come back, you know, if they aren't returned at all or incomplete, then those get forwarded to the Attorney General's office for review. But the Attorney General's office only has, I think, a part-time attorney working on all of the election laws in the state, which I just, I mean, you know, on its face, the idea that New Hampshire, of all places, does not have kind of more oversight of its election laws, I think, is something that everyone on both sides of this would be surprised to learn.
And it doesn't sound like there's more money in the current budget to beef that up a little bit.
I mean, Governor Sununu, he was asked this at a press conference this week. You know, this is a concern of yours. You did not fund the Attorney General's office request to, I think it was a couple hundred thousand dollars. It wasn't a huge amount of money to essentially have a full-time investigator that they sought. And he said he believed that, you know, they could make do and there are efficiencies that can be found. There is a bill that was, you know, proposed to give them $500,000 backed by Democrats. Hard to know where that's going.
There are also a few proposals, though, to shift enforcement away from the Attorney General's office and to the Secretary of State's office, which has raised some alarm bells among a number of people because the Secretary of State's office is not set up as a prosecutorial agency. There's some concerns about not having appropriate oversight from people who are versed in how to conduct investigations. The Secretary of State's office has, you know, asked for some more authority, particularly when it comes to investigating voter ID claims, and said that they would be open to, you know, working with the AG's office on how to make sure they're doing it properly or crafting the appropriate language. But I do think it's interesting just to see this kind of, you know, I don't want to be overly dramatic in describing it as a turf war, but this kind of push-pull between who gets to oversee election law and who is viewed by the respective sides as being the most appropriate place to do that.
Well, there was an editorial in Kevin's paper this week that talked about this. I think the headline was sending out an SOS upon on the Secretary of State's office. And, you know, the editorial ended by saying, if the Attorney General won't defend our voting booths, the Secretary of State is willing to try. I mean, which certainly you know, prompts the question is, you know, he may be willing to try, but like, could he do it? Would there be the resources without actual, you know?
Some of these bills do have a little bit of money attached to them, and it at least sounded like in the initial hearings that Republican lawmakers were perhaps more receptive to the idea of giving the Secretary of State's office a little bit more money to do this. It's unclear how receptive they might be to the idea of giving the AG's office that kind of $500,000 that's requested.
Yes, and Secretary Gardner has told the state Senate that he really wants the ability here to rule on what aren't close calls, what are obvious infractions in the middle of an election season rather than have to wait for a prosecutor. We had the case of the state Senate candidate, Donald Winterton, who was clearly not eligible to vote, yet Bill Gardner had to wait for over almost 10 days before he could actually deem him ineligible to be on the ballot.
All right, why don't we go to the phones? Jonathan is on the line from Manchester. Good morning, Jonathan. Go ahead.
Good morning. I think it's pretty obvious to most people in the state, and I wish people would address it as such, that the attempt to stop college students from voting here in the state is blatant voter disenfranchisement. It takes out a huge percentage of our active voting base here in the state, and obviously it's an attempt by a conservative legislature to cut down on liberal voting here in the state. And we wonder why people, young talent, leave this state. And a lot of it's political, and a lot of it is because they don't see any future here for their vision. Thank you.
All right, Jonathan, thank you. You know, this, you know, the latter point is something that's new to me. The former point is one that we hear over and over again. And, I mean, it's certainly worth pointing out that there are, you know, plenty of precedent and court decision that says, you know, college students can vote where they go to school.
The latter point did come up in a few hearings that I heard on this a few weeks ago, at least in people who are opposing these changes to domicile or residency. Younger people who came out to say, listen, you know, if we want people to be engaged in the state, if we want people to be active, then we have to give them more opportunities to stay civically active, and voting is one way to do that. So that's something that's at least starting to kind of bubble up here. But I mean, it's no secret. You can look at the numbers that in close elections, college towns definitely help Democrats. So from a political standpoint, yeah,
look at the votes out of
Durham. I mean,
but that's not surprising.
This went to the highest. This went to the highest levels of American government. I have it on pretty good authority. President-elect Donald Trump on election night was wondering what the bleep is happening in Hanover and Durham. Meaning, in 2014, Gene Shaheen wins Hanover 3-1. On election night in November, Maggie Hassan and Hillary Clinton win Hanover 6-1. And the same is true in Durham, where Durham went 2.5-1 to Shaheen in 2014 and almost 4-1. For Hassan and Clinton. That's what starts this whole debate. And whether it's unfair or not, that's what has Republicans seeing
red. But
will
the debate ever end?
No.
Unlikely.
Well, you know, but I mean, as these issues, you know, all the bills at the legislature kind of penned and you know, fester, you know, do we know where we're headed? I mean, we think we're going to get a tightening of domicile, and beyond that, murky.
I think we're going to get at least something, whether that's a 13-day residency requirement, whether that is tightening of domicile, whether that's all of the above. I think given the political makeup, this is something that you're much more likely to find Republican consensus on than right to work. And, you know, Governor-elect Chris Sununu has said that he wants to tighten up voting rules. He was one of the ones who, before the election, it's worth remembering, kind of floated this idea that buses were being brought in across New Hampshire. On an interview with Howie Carr, he quickly backpedaled on that.
This. I mean, this week he said, you know, I shouldn't have used the word fraud, but
he nonetheless, you know, what, you know, floated this idea out there that is now being floated by the president, and is very supportive of the idea of kind of changing what he describes as a gray area in the state's election laws. So I would be very surprised if we don't see any changes this session.
All right. We have another email. I find it hard to believe that if there were voter fraud, then Republicans would have won the House and Senate as well as the governorship. But there was some kind of conspiracy against only Ayotte and Trump. Why have I not heard this point made when NPR or anyone else interviews government officials? That is from Io from Pike.
I think one of the important things to remember is that there was no kind of viable third party candidate in the governor's race either, whereas in the Senate and the presidential race, you had, in the case of former Senator Ayotte, Aaron Day, who picked up a sizable number of votes.
What another? I mean, I think there were like 36,000 votes cast for people other than Maggie Hassan and Kellyanne.
Right. And then in the presidential race, you, of course, had Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, whereas at the gubernatorial level, there was not that kind of, you know, other entity to draw votes from.
All right, we'll be back after a short break. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800-892-6477. Keep the emails coming at exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be back after a moment.
Bummed that you haven't heard Outside In for a while? Well, podcast subscribers get fresh episodes every other week. Episodes that answer serious questions like, is there more wind than there used to be?
Not to make light of a serious subject, but I also know that you and your husband hate wind chimes.
Which... Oh man, I can't, not in my backyard. I hate wind chimes.
We're going to get mail about this, I hope.
Subscribe to Outside In and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or Google Play.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Casey McDermott from right here at NHPR. And why don't we go to the phones? A lot of calls in. Let's go to Barbara in Henniker.
Ah, good morning, everybody. Nice to hear you. I'm listening to this debate on voting, and it's the same old thing. Domicile was a big deal while I was in the legislature, and what really bothers me is we just have a group of people who are trying to make it more difficult to vote, more difficult to do what people want to do, and I'm thinking about the whole issue of gerrymandering. Totally unfair, and I certainly support this new approach to doing it, computer-wise or some-wise. Anyway, sounds a lot fairer to take it out of the hands of we the people who only are pushing one point of view.
All right,
it makes me feel bad. We should be promoting voting, no matter what it is.
All right, good to hear from you, former Representative Barbara French of Henniker. And, you know, there was a bill before the legislature to create an independent redistricting commission, which I believe is failing.
It has not failed. I think it failed this week.
Yeah, not going in non-starter. Again, when Republicans have all control of all the levers of power right now at the State House, they're not about to cede away that most powerful job, which is to redistrict voting precincts.
Right, and just for listeners, you know, every 10 years we have the census, and then you have a redrawing of the district boundaries, and that's always been considered, you know, to the victor goes the spoils in many states. I think it's somewhere in sort of the 32 to 34 states, I can't remember the exact number, who still do it through, you know, control
political
of the state
process,
legislature. Okay. Yeah, but there is this kind of move to go to either judges or nonpartisan commissions. And some traction, but not a tremendous amount of traction. This is viewed as kind of and in fact, the Democrats have already geared up for 2020 to try to regain control of more state legislatures so they can control the process and maybe reverse some of the gerrymandering that's
taking place. Well, it is interesting in New Hampshire, if you look at the one time the districts weren't drawn by lawmakers and were drawn, you know, court imposed, I'm not saying it's causation, it did precede Democrats doing better than they had. There were certainly other factors, such as the Iraq War, unpopularity of George W. Bush. But, you know, that is a historical fact, which is interesting to note. And this is something that, you know, Democrats have been pushing. But, you know, as Dean says, you know, to the victors go the spoils within certain parameters. And, you know, there are those who say that this is inherently a political thing and should remain so. Got another call on the line. Margaret from Concord. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you that since we have a large number of people who do not vote, who could vote, who are eligible, shouldn't we be working to make voting more accessible, create more times, longer days, maybe new days that are holidays, so people can vote and participate?
Thank you.
So, Margaret, there are a number of bills that are up before the legislature, not just to change the voting laws in terms of who's eligible to vote, but also to potentially, expand no excuses absentee voting, which is something that we've seen in a number of other states, allowing people to cast a ballot, perhaps if they have a busy work schedule or an unpredictable schedule or just know that they're going to have trouble getting to the polls otherwise. There's other efforts to expand voter registration opportunities, things like that. My inclination is, given the political makeup of the legislature right now, those issues are less likely to gain traction among Republicans. I know that when they were presented, I think there was another bill presented to make Election Day a state holiday, which is something that some other people have just talked about broadly in terms of getting people to vote across the board. They were less receptive to that idea, at least in the hearing room. We'll see how those pan out when they kind of, you know, move forward to
and
the floor.
Republicans will argue that that's a separate issue, that you can certainly undertake initiatives to make voting easier within the state. And we've seen that, I think, as a whole, the country has made some changes over the last 10 to 20 years. But that's a separate issue of who gets to vote. And the argument you always hear is we just want to make sure that Republicans say we just want to make sure that the people who are voting in New Hampshire are people who live in New Hampshire.
All right. And to that point, why don't we go to Neil on the line from Plymouth. Good morning, Neil. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm all in favor of citizens having a right to vote, and I believe that an informed voter is the best. But I think we should be honest and call a spade a spade. If an out-of-state student can claim domicile in our town and vote, why can't that student claim in-state tuition? I mean, they're claiming domicile, and we're honoring that domicile and allowing them to make the serious decisions in our community. Why can't they be treated as an in-state student?
Well, we're stepping right into the midst of the whole domicile versus resident question, which is a vexing and complicated one, is it not, Casey?
Yeah, the Attorney General's office, when they were testifying actually on this issue of domicile last week, I believe, said that, you know, listen, we don't know what kind of consequences changing this definition is going to have on all kinds of laws, not least of all in-state tuition, insurance laws, motor vehicle laws. There could be a whole cascade of effects by changing just this one definition that is meant to affect the right to vote, but could have a lot of other effects elsewhere. And I think someone told me that I've been meaning to follow up on this, but New Hampshire has a ton of different definitions of what it means to be a resident. I think somewhere in the hundreds,
yes,
potentially.
600, yeah. 600 different definitions.
So there's, you know, in-state tuition is one that obviously comes to mind when you're thinking about college students, but there are a whole host of others that could potentially affect people beyond just college students.
Yeah, it's just important to remember when you're talking about voting and you're talking about domicile, it's really a state of mind. And while the residency laws are much more exact, are much more precise, to Neil's point, and these students who have an intention to be here and claim that they have a right to be here and eligible to vote here could not qualify as in-state students under the rigorous standards that those laws apply.
Well, but there have been issues with college student participation in civic life.
Yes.
You know, there was the issue with the Grafton County treasurer who, you know, got elected in one of the big Obama waves and then, you know, basically wasn't carrying out the job and you know, was ultimately stepped down. But, you know, this has been a point of tension and, you know, it's unlikely to get resolved anytime soon, I think it's fair to say. We've got more emails on this. This is from Anonymous, who says, if someone does sign an affidavit who doesn't live in New Hampshire, is their vote counted automatically, or does the affidavit have to be verified before the vote is counted? And when somebody doesn't, you have to be domiciled in New Hampshire to vote. So there's a terminological question, but no, there are not provisional balloting for people who do not have IDs.
There's a proposal to create a provisional ballot system. I'm not sure where that is exactly in the legislature right now, but that's one of the questions that's come up is that, okay, right now those votes are counted alongside everyone else's, but, you know, one Republican lawmaker, my understanding is that bill would change it and would do what Anonymous is suggesting and maybe set those aside and not count them in the final tally until they're verified.
We also have an email from Deb who says, well, I am a, quote, mature citizen. I remember the fact that I needed an absentee ballot to vote in college, parentheses, back in the dark ages. Why can't these students get absentee ballots? That way they could contribute to their home communities. And, you know, some college students do vote absentee.
Right. What some college students also say is that this is where I live a majority of the year, 9 months of the year, 10 months of the year in some cases. And in their view, you know, just kind of reiterate it, it's their home. They want to participate in the civic life here because they're maybe more affected by it than the place that they live only 3 months of the year.
And that's a choice they're entitled to
right,
make, basically,
right.
under our legal system. Why don't we go back to the phones? Nashua. Rob is in Nashua. Good morning, Rob. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. I was just going back to the idea of gerrymandering. The whole idea of victors and spoils kind of is a blatant admission that it's disrupting the democratic process, the whole idea of one person, one vote. I was just wondering if you or any of the guests knew of any private citizens or class action lawsuits that were held up against that law, just to have it reviewed and see its constitutionality.
Well, I mean, certainly there have been challenges to individual redistricting maps, and, you know, certainly maps can be challenged. I mean, we had the issues in New Hampshire, you know, back with the 2002 maps when they drew them, or after that census, you know, there's a big case in Massachusetts where, you know, a map was challenged. But, you know, until there's a map, you know, I'm not sure anyone has challenged the notion of political redistricting. Do you know anything about that, Dean?
Like you said, there have been various challenges over the years, and it usually has to do with the function of the composition of the district. If you've ever seen, you can Google, you know, craziest congressional districts online, and it'll give you the top 10, and these things look like Rorschach tests.
Just for kind of a timely thing, I saw some redistricting Valentines on Twitter, which I would recommend seeking out if you're interested in this kind of stuff.
There is software
very
now.
Romantic.
Yeah.
And there is software now that you can literally draw by block or house. I mean, it's quite remarkable. And it's just one of these things. There are sort of ongoing challenges. But as I said earlier, the majority of states still view it as kind of a political benefit for whoever controls the state legislature.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
You know, while the legislature is certainly spending a lot of time on election laws, that's not the only thing going on. I mean, there are bills that seem to be getting short work in the legislature is anything to do with curtailing gun rights. I thought some of the votes this week were interesting in the House. There was a rejection. The House rejected a bill that sought to ban guns at polling places. That came yesterday. Proponents said it would help the state better comport with the federal Gun-Free Schools Act, and that schools are polling places in many towns. Non-existent problems have the prevailing side. The House also voted down a bill yesterday requiring background checks on all gun sales aimed to close the so-called gun show loopholes. This is one area in which, with Republicans in control, people looking to defend gun rights in New Hampshire have got to be feeling pretty good.
Yeah, certainly do. And the gun lobby in New Hampshire is very well organized and feeling its oats, certainly. It's on the precipice of repealing the permit to carry concealed weapon. In fact, they put out a kind of breathless email alert when they learned that law enforcement officials had sent a letter to Governor Sununu urging him not to sign that bill. He certainly will sign that bill. They're very strong. They're very organized. And in this political climate, for the next 2 years, they're holding sway.
Mm. One issue that's likely to be, tougher to pick the outcome, and certainly will last deep into the spring, which is the debate over the state budget. And Governor Chris Sununu visited the Finance Committee room to talk to House and Senate budget writers this week. And it was interesting to hear some of the pushback on, one of the key proposals in his budget, which is targeted full-day kindergarten. Why don't we take a listen to what the governor said when he was questioned about that?
Let's not let great be the enemy of good, right? Let's not do a program because we can't do it 100% maybe for every single town. A lot of these towns that have the means already have programs implemented.
That was Governor Sununu before legislative budget writers talking about his targeted kindergarten proposal. And, Kevin, obviously targeted aid is something we've talked about at great length in the context of, essentially secondary education. And once you start targeting, there's a question of some people don't get something.
Exactly. And I understand why Governor Sununu is pursuing this route. He's certainly got limited resources. He supports the concept of full-day kindergarten and simply feels there are wealthy school districts that are able to pay for it for themselves, so why would the state be giving them a handout? Well, we certainly heard this week from his former Republican primary opponent for governor, Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis, when he presented his budget this week, said full-day kindergarten, if it's available to any student, it should be available to all students. Why are my five-year-olds less deserving of state assistance than the five-year-olds in Lisbon or in Pittsfield, the even more property-poor communities? The pushback really is about the push down and the downshift that the state has made over the past several budgets. This is not Chris Sununu's fault, but as we've seen with revenue sharing, as we've seen with support for public employee retirement plans, the state has systematically stepped away from past commitments of state support for programs at the local level. So they see Governor Sununu come forward with this proposal and say, great, another half loaf is being sent from Concord, and I'm not getting a crumb.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see how I attended his briefing of budget writers. I just kind of wanted to see the looks in their eyes when they saw a Republican sitting across the table them for the first time in a long time. And, you know, they seemed generally pretty receptive in concept. And, you know, these tend to be polite meetings, at least the first one between a governor and lawmakers on this front. But, you know, there's some big questions in the governor's budget proposal that didn't get asked. And one of the ones that I think is going to be interesting to watch is, you know, his budget, you know, in the estimation of hospitals, shorting them, you know, $147 million over the biennium in you know, uncompensated care payments. And, you know, the hospitals, their lobbyists, they were sort of sitting in the room. And, you know, if assuming their reckoning of this is correct, and if there's $147 million that would need to go to them to comply with, you know, settlement of a lawsuit, you know, that's going to make a lot less space for some of the other priorities in this budget.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And
I was going to say on the kindergarten proposal, he's kind of sort of in between the two sides there. You get people who just want to do it and fund it completely and have it be a sort of standard thing for families. And then others who just don't like the idea. And there's this whole kind of pedagogical debate about whether or not it even really has lasting impact to have somebody.
Well, that is one view that, like, Sean Jasper, the House Speaker, he's essentially said, like, he doesn't believe. He believes it's socialization, not education. And so, you know, we'll see where that goes. I mean, certainly again, from the sort of family friendly aspect of it, I think that is a dynamic that will probably push this along.
And I mean, I haven't been around here that long, but it seems like those groups have increased in their lobbying presence and advocacy presence at the State House in recent years too, and might be making a pretty full push on those kinds of fronts.
So. All right, we've got about 15 seconds. What's everyone going to be focusing on next week?
With the you cook your turkey with it and even pick and store pickles. We're looking at salt brine. Some years after starting this,
I wasn't expecting that.
Is salt brine more effective than road salt in terms of snow removal?
Okay, Casey.
Probably more election stuff.
Good for you, Dean.
I'm closely watching our congressional delegation, particularly our U.S. senators. They're just right in the thick of everything down there, and it's just fascinating. They're popping up on cable news on almost a daily basis.
All right, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a good weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.